After nearly a month of protests by Thailand's Red Shirt anti-government movement, the situation in Bangkok has escalated in the last week. Though most of the past month's protests have been peaceful, earlier this week, Red Shirt protesters briefly stormed and held the parliament building. In response, the prime minister declared a state of emergency on Wednesday, giving broader powers to security forces to quell the protests. When the government shut down an opposition TV channel, protesters today seized control of a transmission station in the first violent clash of the recent conflict. That 2010 news report has probably been forgotten by most of us in the past year or two, in part because reports of unrest in Thailand have, well, seemed to be so common for so long. But Thailand also has the world's longest-serving head of state. What forces have kept Thailand balanced for so long? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
It's a country of contrasts, influenced by powerful competing neighbors, India and China. But it's the only Southeast Asian country never colonized by a European power. An ally of Japan during World War II, an ally of the United States after the war. What are the prospects for Thailand in the 21st century? Our guest is Tongchai Wanichakun, professor of Southeast Asian history at the UW-Madison, author of the book Siam Mapped, and president of the Association for Asian Studies.
Oh, welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you.
Let's start with some misconceptions that many of us might have about Thailand, because I think for many people, they may think of the King and I and you know, references to Siam. They might think of recent Saturday Night Live spoofs about learning Thai so that you could converse with prostitutes. You know, we have certain kinds of bits and pieces that find their way into American discourse. What, as a scholar of Thai studies and as somebody from Thailand, what do you find the most annoying in terms of myths and misconceptions?
Well, one day I should write 100 misconceptions about Thailand because many things in your introduction, I think along, no, that's not true, that's not true, that's not true. For example, among the two most important things that people always mention is that first, Thailand is never colonized. That's correct. Formally, it's not colonized. But if you can think of some of the countries in the world which is not colonized, but in a situation similar to Thailand, maybe Brunei, maybe Persia, Iran. At the time, in late 19th century to early 20th century, it was a buffer between the French and the British. They did not want to colonize. Or even they wanted, they prefer not colonizing, keep them as a buffer. But economically and other parts, it's similar to other colonies. So I always, one of the things I talk in the class and have to tell people is, it's not formally colonized. It's not directly colonized. Yet, we can't say that it's not colonized. It's somewhere between. And this is something, there used to be the term semi-colony, which is vague.
Semi-colony because it's not formally colonized, but has a lot of influence.
Yeah, and people, yeah, that's right. People use the word semi-colony in so many different ways. I would say for Thailand, it's that way. It's not formally colonized, but the influence is so much. In terms, and for global economy at the time, colonial economy was part of colonial economy anyway. Second thing is a misconception is about the king. The king helps stabilize the country. That's partly true to a certain time, but the crisis you mentioned from the beginning, in my view, that's because of the king.
Really?
So it's it helped stabilize the country during the Cold War at some huge cost. And now it may be one of the reasons that it become not so stable right now. So I think it is more than that.
Well, Thailand, being where it is in Southeast Asia, has always been in a difficult situation, has it not?
Yeah.
Because,
yeah,
as I mentioned at the beginning, you have India to the west. Uh-huh. You have China to the north.
Yeah.
And even not so far away, Japan.
Mm-hmm.
and during World War II, Japan, when I referred to Thailand being an ally of Japan during the war, I got the impression that this was not a willing ally.
Mm-hmm.
But the realities were that the Japanese
yes.
had the power.
They are a willing ally. Yep. But they know how to play different cards. Maybe that's another mystery or misconception. They are a willing ally. But by the end of the war, that willing ally got out of power. Their opponent, let's say the anti-Japanese faction, came to power. So they are true and willing ally to the U.S. as well.
So it makes you really ask the question, you know, who is Thailand? Because when you talk about Thailand as being an ally of this or country or that country, it sounds like you're overgeneralizing. It sounds as if Thailand has always had these factions that have been struggling one against the other for control of the country and that represent different things.
Isn't it true to every country? I think it is.
To an extent,
yeah.
Of course.
To a certain extent.
Yes, of course.
I wouldn't say that it's different much from other countries. For example, we can think of a few things that Thailand doesn't change much. Different factions are the same. For example, the pro-capitalism with not so strong radicalism, even in the time of during the Cold War, the communists were strong, let's say, for a few years, but overall not very strong. Primarily right now, normally what factions? They are pro-capitalism. That's why the U.S. doesn't worry much, whoever came to power, if you don't mind any changing face. They fight so hard against each other for domestic politics, for international relations, for international policy. Thailand hardly changed because most factions are the same.
What's the most important thing to know about the background for what the former Siam turning into Thailand? Can you give us just kind of a crash course in what Siam was, how it turned into Thailand, and the kind of role it played in both World War One and Two?
I would say Thailand is a kind of caught in the middle. Both the negative and positive consequence of being caught in the middle is that it can be pretty much ignored or neglected for both and bad consequences. Let's say it's not a so powerful country that you have to ignore. You have to pay attention and have to try to exert some influence. Let's say during the Cold War, during imperial power, during the colonialism, it doesn't have so much, the population is not so large. The territory is not so large. On the other hand, it's not a small country that you can really ignore it, no matter what. You don't have to spend a lot. No, they have a pretty good sizable internal market and economy to deal with. 60-something million is not small. So I think for the good and bad consequences, being about mid-size, mid-level, and caught in the middle of so many things have benefited Thailand for hundreds of years. It's not the enemy of so many other countries. On the other hand, people want to make friends. If they respond friendly, it's safe. So I think that's a part. Not much radical and not much extreme. Another thing is this. It is not a secret because writers, travelers from Europe know this since 16th, 17th century up to now. It just happened to be in the area which is so abundant. I mean, because of social stratification, because of those kind of economic system, they can have poverty, a lot of people, but in general, people don't die easily because of no food to eat.
Because it's a farming area?
A lot. Yeah. It's so easy. Mm-hmm. Thailand produced a lot of rice for how many hundred years? Normally much more than they need to consume. They either sell or stop producing, or producing half of their capacity or less than half. They say have enough to eat.
That's different in some ways from the surrounding countries then.
That's right. Mm-hmm. It's in the area there where it is so productive, even by I mean, let's say the rice technology, rice farm technology doesn't change much because they don't need to change.
But no oil.
No oil. That's true. So that's in the modern world, things have to change and society become much more complex. And that's part of the problem, in my view, is that a lot of things in Thailand change so slow. In the kind of country or society caught in the middle with abundant resources, they don't need to change fast. But not anymore. The world has changed much faster. The world has moved away from agrarian society. If they still produce food in the same way as for, they didn't do the same way. They change slowly. They need to change faster for the world and social issues, population complexity in the society become much more complex, much more delicate. And the society, the political system, seems to not responding to that change very well.
No, it sounds like you have some experience in that regard, some opinions in terms of the failings of the Thai government, or I should say governments over a period of time, because they change fairly often, don't they? Other than the monarch himself.
They change very often, but they are pretty much the same.
Can you say something about the political structure in Thailand, the extent to which the monarch has actual power as opposed to being a figurehead? What sort of democracy exists and when it came into being?
It's a British parliamentary system, Westminster system, with all the little differences here and there. I mean, different from England, amount to a lot of difference. Primarily since 1949, after World War II, it called itself the democratic system with the monarchy as the head of the state. I mentioned this because most of the world look at that and then they thought, okay, it's like the British. The monarchy is the head of the state, nothing. In Thailand, it's not. It turns out that either the military rules for 20-something years during the 60s and 70s, the semi-democracy in the 80s, semi because there's election, but the government, elected government doesn't have all the power. The upper house, they rule by appointed people, by the military. Negotiation of power with the military have to take place from time to time, that kind of thing. Until the 90s to the present, the role of the I better call the monarchist, because I'm not talking about the king alone. I'm talking about a political force, a group, a network of people who, in the name of the monarch, in the name of the king, they do this, they do that. They interfere, they intervene in politics all the time in the name of the monarchy. They refuse the government, elected government authority from time to time in the name of the monarchy. For example, the judge or the military, they can claim that they are soldiers of the monarch, so they don't listen to the government. The judge say that, no, they don't belong to government. It's true, they choose to be independent. But in fact, they talk about, I'm a judge in the name of the monarchy, so I can do...
Sounds as if almost anybody can claim that, at least anybody
it turns
in
out,
a couple of branches
it turns
of government.
Out you can say anybody can claim that, but it turns out some truth in it, meaning the monarchy and the monarchies intervene in elected democratic system from time to time a bit too often.
And so if I'm living in Thailand, let's say I'm living in Bangkok, who do I vote for, and what role in my life would the monarch play?
The way it works the way I explain to people is that the monarchy is supposed to be above, right? Above politics. What does above mean? Above, in this sense, when we talk about monarchy, is supposed to be above more politics. British monarchy, it should be above more politics, meaning get out, don't involve, right? Even her speech has to gone through a certain process of she can't speak, she can't suddenly televise her opinion by herself. She can't, right?
Right.
In Thailand, they can do that.
In Thailand, the monarch can speak?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, the monarch can come out, reprimand the politicians. But do we elect the monarch? No.
No.
No way. Do we elect the monarchists who act in the name of the monarch? No. So anyway, it becomes a system that we have elections, we have government. But above that, above here doesn't mean not involved, I mean on top of that.
Mm-hmm. Undone. So
that seems like almost like an oxymoron then to have a democratic situation. So
I wrote an article called Royalist Democracy. People, how can you have royalist democracy? But because one system. And one system seems like everywhere else, but the other system, unelected, undeclared, but we know that it's on top of normal political process.
So was it an absolute monarchy before 1949?
Before 1932, okay. And when I got your question about asking about politics about after World War II, people tend to think about in terms of Thailand switch from Japan to the ally. I think there is another factor in domestic politics. The end of absolute monarchy is 1932. From 1932 to 1947, it's a kind of post-revolutionary period where that's a period of World War II too, right?
Oh, okay. Yes.
For domestic politics, it's a struggle. It's still a struggle for the revolutionary in 32 who ended the absolute monarchy and the monarchists who tried to return to power.
So there was a revolution in 1932?
Yeah.
Succeeded.
To topple to the absolute monarchy successful, yes. And then 15 years after that, they still hold on to power because the monarchy was still a threat. So in 1947, 49, the monarchies came back. People don't know this. Mm-hmm. They don't came back in terms of establishing absolute monarchy. No. They came back to establish the system that I explained a moment ago.
The part that's like a layer above.
Yeah. Yeah.
What about communism, which played such a huge role in neighboring China? What role did and does communism play in Thailand?
It's a major opponent to the military rule from the late 50s to about the early 80s, which is coincide with the Cold War, global Cold War anyway. Major opponents in terms of in Thailand at the time, there's no real opposition. Military rule from 1949 to 1973. After that, it's kind of on and off until about late 1980s. So the whole period, no real opposition. Turns out that the communists become alternative, but then they are illegal, so they operate mostly outside Bangkok, mostly in the jungles. And let's say, to what extent is a consequence or the effects of the Cold War? A lot, of course. On the other hand, it has its own reason for domestically as well. So it's a major alternative, major opposition. But let's say, were they very strong, powerful in the minds of Thai people? No. Thai people mostly look at communism. Maybe part of it is it's a result of propaganda. They don't like that. So certain period, from time to time, there were, stronger activism by the radicals, by the pro-communism or pro-socialists. But for most of the time, one reason U.S. take Thailand as a good ally during the Cold War because the influence of communism is not that great.
Well, if Thailand is and has been as prosperous as you indicate, just on the basis of its agriculture, then there would not be the kind of inequity and the kind of discontentment that communism would be able to take hold in.
It starts with, you're right. It starts with the so-called economic modernization around the 1960s. Increasing problem, urban problem, also increasing inequality.
Oh, really? Because of modernization?
We can say that. I'm not anti-modernization, but, a lot of things in the world change. There are plus and minus go together. You can't choose. So this is one of them. Economic development, so substantial, material life, quality of life much better, but the consequence is inequality. Thailand right now, we know this for the past 10, 20 years, but somehow the country hasn't changed, have not been able to change this much. Thailand is one of the countries that having inequality and disparity, strongest in Southeast Asia, I believe.
You're saying Thailand has more inequity than other countries around
it? Because they have this burgeoning, modernization,
industrial sector, urban sector. Because the first phase of modernization almost everywhere in the world is built around industrial, income substitution, small industrial cities, primary cities, and suppressed agrarian agriculture sector. That's 10, 20 years. It creates a lot of problems, and it looks like we haven't got over that yet.
So it sounds as if Thailand is, to use a kind of an interesting word, the most progressive of the Southeast Asian countries. And that is from that's where the inequity comes from, progressive in terms of technologically, economically.
Except Singapore, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Singapore, yeah.
Singapore,
which is another thing altogether, isn't it? Yes.
Yeah.
And who controls the army, the military in Thailand?
Hard to say. I think it is a political force in itself. But let's say the main ally is the monarchies.
Okay, so the military throughout this period and the monarchy in Thailand.
I wouldn't say throughout the period, but let's say for the past maybe since mid-70s.
But you've had the same
20, 30 years already. Mm. Yeah, okay. That's right.
You've had the same monarch since 1946, yeah. Which is a world record.
Yeah.
And presumably then the military, it has been with the blessing of the military throughout that time.
The coming back of the monarchies in 1949 that I mentioned earlier, historians and non-historians agree is a work of the alliance between the monarchies and the army.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But to some period between mid-1960 to mid-1970s, they're not quite the same side.
Not quite the same interests.
Yeah. That's where the reputation of this monarch as a democratic come from. Because in the 73, there was an uprising. And the monarch showed a gesture supporting people who want to topple the monarchy. That's when and where the reputation come from. And since then, especially people who are not close observer, even close observer can be, misunderstood this. They see the monarchy as a, no matter what, the military gone, new government come, the monarchy provide is a stability factor. And also on the side of the pro-monarchy. In 2010, when there was a killing, there was a massacre in Bangkok, people asked, where is the monarch? Why he didn't come out as before? I didn't provide the answer. I asked, why do you expect him to come out?
Mm-hmm.
Because your assumption is that he always come out. That assumption is wrong. It's not that he should or he shouldn't. That doesn't bother me up to the monarchy's decision. But the assumption, the observer assumption, that the monarch always or usually come out to stop the killing, that's not true. There are four major uprisings in Thailand from 1973 to 2010. Four major uprisings, four major killings. He came out twice. He didn't come out twice. So it's a tie.
Well, we're going to talk about those uprisings. We also maybe will talk about your own role as a student activist when we continue in a moment on University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Hong Chai Wanichakun, and he's telling us about a fascinating country, a country of contradictions, Thailand, and its role in not just its own history, of course, but its relations with the greater world in Southeast Asia and with the United States over the course of time. And you mentioned these four uprisings in this long, long-term monarchy, constitutional monarchy that Thailand has had in 1973, 76, 92, and then in 2010.
Yeah.
And in some instances, the monarch, the king, would actually come out and mediate or somehow make a statement. and in others he would not, which is kind of an interesting inconsistency, I guess, in itself, or apparent inconsistency. You, as a student, did you have direct experience with the first of these uprisings?
I was in high school. I was in the street, joining hundreds of thousands of people walking, marching the street that eventually led to a kind of rising against the military rule at the time.
So what were you protesting when you were walking in the street?
At the time, the military had ruled the country for 26 years. There's a series of events. We asked for a constitution. In Thailand, constitution, by now, I think it's 18 constitutions. Anyway, functionally, it's not like in the U.S., but symbolically.
Uh-huh.
Just symbolically. Mean we have real constitution, but the function, you can tore it down so many times. But having a constitution somehow represents that we are having, I'm not saying we have, sometimes we are having democracy. In 73, after for so long, no constitution, there is military constitution, of course, we are talking about democratic constitution. So we call for that. Of course, they deny. So the demonstration, have the constitution as a target. We wanted up to give them 6 months or so. After 6 months demonstration, again, this you refuse. It turned out to be uprising.
And what did you want from a constitution? What were the situations, the effects on your everyday life that you wanted changed?
Having elections. Because one major thing in the military constitution, they call it, we have constitution, what do you call for? The difference is that in military constitution, no election. The constitution, we won't have elections. I think that's the main thing.
Pretty much for their own sake, or did you have specific things that you want to change? And under military rule, did you have certain legal rights as Thai citizens, or was there, for example, no need to have a reason to arrest somebody in Thailand?
A lot of details, lots of them can be debated forever. But in general, the trend is that we want more freedom. I wouldn't say absolute freedom or guarantee freedom. Just say we're talking about 73 up to now, right?
Right.
More freedom, more liberty. Election seems to be the common point. People agree. Until recent years, have to mention that, because until recent years, people now, there are certain sector in the society, Thai society now, think elected democracy maybe is not good for Thailand, because Thailand is so special. We put that aside. But in general, in 20, 30, how many years already? 70, something,
40
years already. Mm-hmm. Having elections, having elected government, seems to be, even though a lot of details within that too, such as what kind of system election,
sure.
That I'm not going to go to that, or even the upper house, they're still struggling throughout this time, they're struggling until now, to what percentage, what proportion elected upper house, what proportion appointed upper house, that kind of things. But let's say at least have elections in the lower house. That's the common theme.
And how did that play out in 73? Did your protest work? And it sounds like it's a peaceful
that
protest.
The result is that we ended the military rule. Even though consequently that, like every other revolution, I might say, in this case, not revolution by revolutionary party, but by people uprising, it changed a lot. Two or three things happened. One is like the dam is exploded. So a lot of things flood the society, mm-hmm. including radical ideas.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Uh-huh.
So that's why 3 years after that, Thailand turned radicalized, especially among the youth, among the student movement, which I'm one of them.
But the monarchy or the monarchists, and even the military to some extent, must have sympathized with your demands or the things that you were asking for.
No, the opposite.
Mm-hmm. Well, then how did you pull it off?
We are the threat. And keep in mind that 73 uprising, right? What happened 2 years after that? Indochina Revolution. Mm-hmm. To bring in the international context, we become, I think they're frightened. The establishment were frightened by radical movement. Suddenly, they saw us as a proxy of the communists. So the result is that 3 years after that, 1976, a brutal murder, brutal massacre in Bangkok in 1976.
To crack down radical movement. I was going to ask you, you know, to what extent were you demonstrating for freedom of speech, freedom of press, and how did you get around sort of the propaganda of the monarchs?
That is always an issue throughout 40 years. To some certain period, we gain a lot. Certain period, we kind of fall back. Like in 70s, I wouldn't say it's among the top agenda, but it's among the high agenda that we call freedom of the press, freedom of expression. But still, every society, even here, so more than that in Thailand, have to find a line where is the freedom.
Yes, of course,
is.
Right. Yeah.
So I wouldn't say that we call for absolute freedom. Maybe it doesn't exist in the world, but let's say in Thailand, it's much more restricted. So that's the issue of fighting all the time. And in 40 years, I think most people, at least I speak for myself, I'm willing to fight for that because the line is not clear. But it's so restricted, especially about the monarchy. Mm-hmm. Until now, after 40 years, that line, how much we can talk about the monarchy, we still have no freedom.
And were you ever in danger yourself? Or arrested or...
I was arrested after the massacre in 76. The charge includes so many things. I was jailed for 2 years.
You were in jail for 2 years?
Yeah.
Charged with?
Communists, killing the police, subversive to government, Les Majesty, 11 charges, I don't remember. In the end, got out by amnesty, politics changed. So I got out and then went on to finish my degree, went on to study, but spent 2 years in jail, political prisoner. So after that, I paused a moment ago, I'm in danger or not. I think I have to say yes. But it doesn't mean that always come as a threat. No, I have to learn how to play it. Everybody in Thailand have to learn. For example, especially the press. At some point, Thailand, in the mid-80s to mid-90s, people think, oh, Thailand has the most free press in Southeast Asia. It's true. They never touch the monarchy. Why? They know how to self-censor.
Well, sure.
We learn how to self-censor. We learn what to speak. The country where, the society where we learn a lot how to speak properly in terms of hierarchy. We learn how to speak, what is proper to speak of the monarchy, what is proper to shut up.
Well, you know, it wasn't all that long ago that in England, if you said the wrong thing in the press about the monarchy, you would get jailed.
Yeah.
so it's a fairly widespread phenomenon, I suspect.
So freedom in terms of monarchy, I would say... No. Then depends on what you think. For example, you will feel satisfied. You don't have to cross that line. But whenever you happen to be the person who wants to cross that line, then you feel pretty frustrated. For me, I'm both. To some extent, we don't have to talk. But once we talk about so many problems with the monarchies involved, we have to talk. Then we are not allowed.
So there's two other uprisings then.
Okay. 76, brutal crushing of the radicals, right? And then way to the 1992, after the monarchies and the military kind of stepped back in the 80s. In 1991, for some reason, it's too much detail to explain, the military tried to return to power in 1991. A coup, successful for 1 year, then people fight back. In 1982, and successfully, that's really the end of the military role in Thai politics. Since 1992, the reshuffle of the... Normally, it used to be an important news. Every year, you have to have speculation, have to know who is the army in chief, until about mid-90s. From 92, nobody cares, because the military retreated.
Why?
That's the fighting in 1992 until 2010, that another uprising now, a totally different situation.
Why did the military retreat? I mean,
They lost in the uprising.
How
could they lose? I mean, the military, which I gather is a pretty good size one given the population of the country, has all of the, well, all of the firepower. How could they lose to civilians who presumably weren't even armed?
I would say, first, don't discount the power of the people. Even if they don't have arms, they fought for 3 days. They fought for 3 days.
What, with rocks or what? I mean,
a lot of things.
Uh-huh.
Was some of it civil disobedience?
That's the my one.
The guy who gets hauled off.
Uh-huh. The highway in the street, a lot of people die. 70-something people die on and off here and there. And that one, in fact, in 92, is a kind of rising, is a kind of riot that spread a bit further, I mean, out of the most other three other cases, mostly restricted in certain area. Even 2010 a bit broader, but and 1970 a bit broader, but not as broad as in 1992. It happened everywhere, so many places.
And the military
realized that one factor. The second factor, I agree. We have to give credit to Mana. Mm-hmm. He broke the truth. But partly, if I want to maintain my criticism, because the interest of the monarchists at the time was not with the military anymore.
Do you have a sense at all that there was any kind of outside, well, if not interference, interest in what was going on in Thailand?
Many American friends of mine asked that. As far as, I'm talking as a historian, the evidence so far show not strong. Look at the 73. It's a winding down of the Vietnam War.
Yes.
America wants to pull out safely.
Yes.
Basically safely. They don't care much about others.
Right.
And also, another factor I told you earlier, no matter what government, civilian or military, a bit radical, except the communists, which is not very strong, right? A bit my socialism. None of them deny the role and importance of capitalism. All of them have a kind of similar economic trajectory, growth, industrialization. So the U.S., I think, smart enough to figure it out, none of them are U.S. enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe except the radical years, in those 3 years, but we don't really have power. I was one of them at the time. We are kind of hot-headed, but we don't really have power.
And right now in Thailand, would you say there are a lot of people in jail who are activists or who are speaking up about human rights?
Yes.
I mean, are there a lot of political prisoners right now?
The latest round of political prisoners started in 2006 coup. Again, as the military retreated in 1992, up to 2006, now the main conflict is between elected system and the monarchists, the upper floor and the lower floor, not the upper house, lower house, the two-tier system, the top tier and the lower tier. The military was revived by the monarchists. I'm not saying that they are under the command of the monarchists. No, I don't know. It's maybe like a genie of the lamp you can't control. But let's say still very much in alliance with the monarchists. Since then, a lot of political prisoners, especially about the monarchy, because after 2006, and not just the critique or the opponent of the military review this, the military themselves claim, brag, and with evidence that hinting at the monarchy supported them. And it's true. I believe so too. And nobody ever denied. So a lot of people disillusioned. Mm. Not small disillusioned, because these people not like a subscriber of radical ideas or fixed ideology. No, they just love the monarchy, which is ideology, but a kind of vague.
Because of a sense of tradition?
Yeah. Then one day they found out, this is kind of huge. So I would say a lot of people now disillusioned. A lot, I mean, not into a thousand, maybe almost half the country.
And how important would you say religion is in Thailand in terms of religious freedom
so
and diversity?
So far, Thailand is pretty conservative country, well, like everywhere else, maybe. They are Buddhist. They are a good Buddhist country. They don't have a religious conflict. Of course, all kind of minor, but major ones, no. And part of it because the religious establishment, they can be most of the time conservative, cause trouble from time to time, but mostly minor. So people still very much Buddhist. Both sides in the conflict right now never say anything against Buddhism and even maybe criticism in a small ways to Buddhist establishment, but not in a big way. So I don't see religion becomes an issue, except another crisis in the country right now, which is about the Muslim in the southern border connected to their Malay people, connected to Malaysia. In that part, religion is an important thing.
What's the connection, if any, between Buddhism and what seems to be a fairly low level of violence even in these conflicts in Thailand?
I agree. On that point, I agree very much. Overall, one thing I keep reminding my friends in Thailand, I speak almost like a heartless, with heartlessness. After all, the crisis in Thailand seems to be minor compared to many others in the world. The corruption in Thailand seems to be minor, even though they thought this is the worst crisis in the world. I think minor in the world. The brutality, the success and failure seems to be, I'm coming back to the issue I said at the beginning, it's a kind of caught in between. Thailand never have a real world-scale crisis.
Right.
World-scale casualty, brutality. World-scale success, rich wealth, or whatever, world-scale calamity. I don't think Thailand ever faced that. It's somewhere in the middle. So I think it contributes, in my view, that plus and minus too. The minus is that people seem to be don't know about much about Thailand except things they know well, tourism, other things. But they don't understand it well. They don't spend much time because it's not a hot issue. It's not a hot place.
Right.
Because it's not a sensational story.
No, not sensational, not so significant strategically in world scale either. Even in the Cold War, we may think it's long, 15, 20 years, but in a historical time, well, it's a blip. It's a blip. They need Thailand as an airbase to bomb Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos.
Right.
That's all. That's brutal enough. So most casualties are in Laos and Cambodia. That's brutal, but not in Thailand itself.
So Thailand really didn't have a great impact from the Vietnam War and the war that, of course, spilled over into much of Asia.
I agree. And so the risk, the consequence of that is people don't know much, don't even care to know it better. But the upside is that I believe there's connection between that fact and, on the other hand, the fact that all factions in Thailand are not really extreme.
More on Thailand when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. Our guest is Professor Thong Chai Wanichakun, and we are talking about Thailand, past and present. What do you see as sort of Thailand going forward? You have an aging monarch, you know, long-lasting monarch. What do you think will happen when he dies?
Okay. Let me introduce two other things very briefly. The crisis, political crisis since 2006, since the coup in September 2006, and polarization in the country right now, the past 6-7 years. I believe the three main factors, and then one of them is about succession issue, is about the ailing monarch. So the first two first. First is a changing socioeconomic. We talked briefly a moment ago about modernization, income disparity, economic disparity, not just income. At the same time, it produced a lot of middle class, whose aspiration, political aspiration, and political mode of political operation are not the military rule. That's why it led to 1973. This time again, more and more now it becomes clearer that there is a big change underneath the whole thing, this time in agrarian sector.
In the agrarian sector?
In the sense that the majority of people who work in the field right now, actually starting from the late 80s, 88 or 89, they are no longer peasantry. They become more and more like farmers here. Mode of living, lifestyle, mode of political operation, day-to-day economic activities are so different from peasants. Like, they become semi-urban. Most of them become semi-urban. Income come from urban, too. They enjoy elections because they can work with politicians to bypass the bureaucrat, the strongly super-centralized bureaucrat who never served them. They have politicians as alternatives, so they love elections. That's why the coup in 2006 broke their heart. And once you know the monarchy is a part of it, it's just disillusion. So let's say that underneath it changed for the past two decades. And we know it, but we never recognize in political terms until they show their force. This is what they want. And then denied by the military plus the monarchists. So the second factor is the success of electoral democracy. I call it success, even though it's lots of corruptions, I wouldn't deny it. A lot of mistakes, which is, in my view, is normal for every electoral government.
Right.
Our it is people, you know, when the last time the mafia in Chicago got arrested involving politics, it was 100 years ago, I told them 2 weeks ago. The success means with all kinds of negative, all kinds of problems too. But let's say in primarily, we have to say it's a success. And the third factor is what I talked about a moment ago, is a two-tier system. In the past 20 years or so, starting 73, but primarily strongly since 19, I would say definitely since mid-80s up to now, the monarchies have a lot of leverage in terms of power. With this system, they did, and the last act is a coup 2006 that people denied, people didn't want anymore. But they want to maintain that system. So that's a conflict. People didn't want that, a success of the electoral democracy, but they want to maintain that kind of royalist democracy. I call it royalist democracy for that two-tier system. Now, the crucial thing is that the royalist democracy in Thailand right now, the current, meaning the past 20 or 30 years, depend very much on the present king. The person depend very much on King Bhumibol. His aura, his whatever, his charisma, including the simple fact that he has been the only king for the past 60 years, meaning what? Meaning everybody in Thailand who's still functioning, maybe 70 years old and down.
Can't or remember anyone count, else.
Yeah, they never know anybody else.
That's an interesting and a pretty unusual situation,
yeah,
isn't it? He is
that's
the
right.
king.
That's right.
He's
and
not
does
a
he
king.
Have
so I would say that this present, the current royalist democracy cannot go on. Even I love it. I believe that it cannot go on because it depends on the person. It happened to be a person successful in his role. I wouldn't say that he is truly successful, truly good. I think that's debatable. We are not allowed to debate, but that's debatable. He has some good, some bad as usual. But let's say the reputation that people seem to know, most people in Thailand for sure, that he's super good, almost like semi-god, that's part of the propaganda. That's part of the not allowing people to speak out. But I would say if Thailand has come to this point, democratization has gone to this point without relying so much on the monarch, it has a good future.
And what,
now it relies so much on the person. That's why I say at the beginning, the monarchy become a source of instability. Sorry.
Yeah, I just was wondering, does he have heirs? And normally, would it be, as in Britain, a thing where it is a biological passing of the...
You think about Prince Charles and ten times of that. His reputation is not just... First of all, it's hard. The reputation of the present king has built up so much one-sidedly to the point that nobody can fill his shoes. Everybody will fail, even before they become the king or the queen, whatever. Everybody, whoever comes, cannot fill his shoes. He or she has to find a niche to be successful. He can't imitate. And the royalist democracy system is where a lot of monarchies hang their hats on the monarchy right now, cannot go on with the next king easily. We need a super special person who can find a niche because they can't compare with the present king. It happened next. It happened to be that the heir to the throne is the opposite.
What do you see as the most exciting potential in Thailand besides the opening up of democracy after the passing of the monarch?
In the past few years, I kept talking about history. It happened once in the turn from the present king, Rama the Ninth. It happened once in the turn from Rama the Fifth to the Sixth. Rama the Fifth, good reputation. Nobody can compare to him. That one is absolute monarchy. He ruled so long, 42 years. Rama the Sixth, the heir to the throne, came to power. He's an artist. Not only he can't fill the shoes, it just happened that he's incompetent politically, administratively. I think I keep telling this story. So I don't know. I have to say that most people in Thailand, analysts and experts on Thailand are still blank on this. What's the future? Because we can see that the safe way to go, but we don't. The safe way to go is that the royalist democracy withdrew. I mean, don't let people have democracy mother it through, find its own way. They don't trust politicians. They don't trust elected people. In some ways, they're right. But to the extent that they destroy the system instead of letting it work out its own
problem.
Yeah. So we know that is a way out. Is it a realistic expectation? It's like me too, analysts, hang a hope, please. We hope for the enlightened monarch again to realize that it's time for them to go. Which doesn't mean to abolish the monarchy. No, not many people, only if some people, small group of people might think that way. But most people prefer now stay away, really above politics. Let democracy work its way out.
Thong Chai Wanichakum, thank you for joining us for this hour and spreading a lot of light in a dark area for most of us, which is the fascinating, contrasting country of Thailand. Been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.